House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 21st, 2011. The first item on the agenda today is a public hearing on House Bill 2721. And I would like to call Representative Tomei, Representative Hunt, and Senator Starr, please.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative from Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2721 today, a bill dealing with faith healing. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the tragic deaths that have occurred in Clackamas County. In the past 2 years alone, two children have died, and another has been severely disfigured, and I think you have some information that shows a child with a disfigurement. Their parents refused to seek medical treatment, but instead they relied solely on spiritual treatment for their children. These children had readily treatable diseases. These children suffered needlessly. Their deaths were avoidable. And this suffering and needless death is not new to Clackamas County. This has been happening for years. When you go to the cemetery and look at the headstones and see all those children's names and their ages, you say to yourself, this time, this is enough. It is time now to protect all of our children equally. We shouldn't have separate rules and special treatments for parents with certain religious beliefs. It's time to hold all parents to the same standards. And that is exactly what House Bill 2721 does. It removes the religious exemptions for serious crimes involving victims younger than 18. It removes language singling out faith healing parents who use faith healing for lighter sentences in certain crimes or for favorable consideration in abuse and neglect. There's a long legislative history regarding Oregon and faith healing. The last changes to our laws were in 1999. I have worked with Clackamas County District Attorney John Foote and Assistant District Attorney Greg Horner to develop the language in this bill, and you will hear from them shortly about more details. You will also hear from advocates, child abuse prevention personnel, and medical professionals. I'm supplying you with a copy of Susan Nielsen's recent op-ed piece in the Oregonian, and you have written testimony from the Christian Science Church on this matter, and we do have somebody from the Christian Science Church here in the audience. Representative Hunt and Senator Saar are here to say a few words, and just in closing, I will read the last line of the testimony received from John Clegg on behalf of the Christian Scientists, and I quote, "Spiritual care should never be practiced at the expense of a child's life." Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I've been before this committee in multiple sessions advocating for religious liberty, for religious free exercise, and I am very much a strong believer in religious freedom. But when we're in a circumstance where children are dying or being disfigured without receiving medical attention, we can't allow the parents, who are in this case the perpetrators of that neglect, to use their religion as a defense for the conduct that's detrimental to their kids. As Representative Tomei said, our DA John Foote can outline several of the recent cases, but we've got a long history, at least in Clackamas County, of situations that are detrimental to the health and safety and lives of these children. And it all is being associated with the Followers of Christ Church in Oregon City, which is shunning medical advice, proactively shunning advice, medical treatment from their kids, simply in favor of faith healing. The deaths of these children were preventable, they were needless, and I think it's time that we pass this legislation and say enough is enough. Denying Oregon children who have no legal say in the decisions of their parents' chosen religious practices is, in my view, negligent and can't be tolerated any further in our state. We live, fortunately, in a society which has tremendous medical practices and medical treatment that, if utilized, would have prevented almost all of these tragedies. It's time to treat all parents equally under the law, as Representative Tomei said, and make sure that we give a voice to the children who currently do not have a voice under the law. Oregon courts under this bill would still be able to exercise considerable discretion through the charging decisions of prosecutors, the oversight of judges, and the latitude of juries, but the discretion would be the same for all parents regardless of their beliefs. Now, I will say, I believe in the power of prayer. I believe that God can heal. But I also believe that God has given us doctors, nurses, hospitals, medical providers, and for us to give a tool to parents to say they can use their religion as an excuse for not treating their kids who have no say in this, I think it's long past time to say no to that and make sure that we're protecting Oregon kids and making sure they get the medical treatment they need. I urge your support for House Bill 2721.
Thank you very much. Senator Starr, please.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the state senator from Western Washington County, representing the great communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains. It's a privilege to be here to testify in favor and support of House Bill 2721. I don't come to this issue without any history. 1999 seems like a very long time ago. It was my freshman session in the Oregon House of Representatives, and I, along with former representative from Oregon City, Kathy Lowe, co-sponsored legislation then to remove the shields that were currently in the law as it related to faith healing. That was a difficult and controversial bill in 1999. Without, I believe, some seasoned legislators and lawmakers, particularly Senator Bryant here that in the Senate that chaired this Judiciary Committee, we were able to move a compromise piece of legislation in 1999. What you see here in House Bill 2721 is what I see as completing the job that we began in 1999. It was my goal when we passed the bill then that we would not have any more children die. Prior to 1999, the 99 session, there was a number of children that had died that kind of culminated in needing to act at that particular time. And as you look back since 99 until just a couple of years ago, I believe that for the most part, it worked. There weren't deaths in Oregon City. We are where we are today, and I believe it is time to completely remove the particular exemptions that are in the law for parents that rely solely on faith as their means to protect their children's health. Clearly, that doesn't work. Clearly, we have children that have died, children that have had significant and serious health problems that, as you've heard, can very well be prevented. I absolutely believe that every parent ought to be treated equally under the law. My wife and I, if we were to treat our children in the same manner as parents have in this particular case, particularly in Oregon City, we'd be prosecuted. We'd likely be in jail. That's not right. It's not the way that we ought to treat Oregon moms and dads. It's certainly not the kind of protection that Oregon children deserve under the law. I believe that this is the right time. I believe that House Bill 2721 is the right bill, and I would ask that you move this bill with a due pass recommendation unanimously to the House floor so we can get it to the Senate so that we can get this law changed, statute changed, and that we can protect Oregon children. I appreciate the work of District Attorney Foote from Clackamas County and his deputy, Greg Horner. I think they've done a tremendous job within the constraints of the current law. And to have them here, I believe, supporting House Bill 2721 is important. The other advocates that are here, I commend them for taking the time. There's folks that have traveled from out of state to work on this particular piece of legislation so that we can correct the statute, again, complete the work that we began 12 years ago. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. I appreciate the chair's hearing this bill. I commend it to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and we'd like to thank you, all three of you, for the work you've done getting this bill ready to go. I know Representative May has been working on it quite a bit, a long time, and thank you, Senator Starr, for hanging in there since 1999 to see the improvement. Thank you. And Representative Hunt as well, thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call John Foote, Greg Horner, and Doug Harkleroad.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger. My name is John Foote. I'm the DA. I'm not sure which mic. I'll give Doug his mic.
Doug, there's a seat on the end if you want to get your own mic. Thank you.
Sure. My pleasure to be here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2721. I'd like to give you a little bit of background. With me today is Chief Deputy Greg Horner of my office, who tried the first two cases that you've read about in the newspaper that have been completed. We have two other cases pending trial that we can't talk about for lots of different reasons, fairness to the defendants being one. So we can't talk about those. But let me give you a little bit of background, and then maybe Greg can give you a little bit of just a snapshot of each case to give you a sense of what this is about. Because this, for us, is really very fact-specific. It's not a...
It's an intellectual debate about faith
or kids or the reach of government. It's very much a real thing. And that's really out of which that reality is why we're here. And I first would like to thank Representative Tomei and Senator Starr in particular for their leadership on this. They've reached out to us over time.
We've had lots of conversations about this, and we concluded that this was the right time for this.
So, having said that, let me give you a little bit of background. The problem we have is a particular denomination in Oregon City that the medical examiner estimates has lost more than 20 children in the last 25 years, all of which were preventable. I mean, these are, Greg will go into the cases a little bit, the two we had, but they are tragic when you realize how preventable they were. And it's really in that environment that we're talking, because really our purpose here is to prevent these from happening, not to prosecute people. I mean, we will do that as part of the prevention, but we really want to prevent them. And we tried to do that since 2001 when I came into office. We've reached out to the church on a number of occasions. Back in 2004, Greg went up and met with the leadership of the church to let them know that we would, in fact, prosecute these cases. We didn't want to catch them by surprise. Our preference was that they would take that and that we meant it, and protect their children. We think we had some success with that in combination with the change in the statute. But we did have some deaths. And then in 2010, after we completed the first two cases, I thought it was time to reach out to the church again. So I wrote a letter, and we got a roster of the membership. And I wrote an individually addressed letter to every member who was listed, over 400 members, asking them for a conversation about this, how we might be able to reach common ground. And I've had spattering responses, but really the point was I wanted them to know that we really were not about prosecuting them, we were about them protecting their kids. And that's what we really wanted. And I felt it was important for them to hear that in a private, individual way, not through the leadership of the church. Now, the information we have is that things are changing in the church. Not that anyone will ever tell you this publicly, but that more and more families are, in fact, protecting their children. But we do believe there is a core in the church that simply is not going to change. And what they need to feel from us is our resolve that we will hold them accountable. And this change in statute, we believe, is an important part of that message, especially for those parents in the church who really do want things to change. And without pressure from the outside, things are not going to change in that church. This has been going on a long time. It's difficult to describe the environment in a denomination like this, which is very protected. This is a family that's very, a church that's very entrenched in the community and very connected. They go to the schools. They have businesses. They're very much involved in the community, but they are very self-contained. And for somebody to leave the church, it's very, very difficult to break the rules because they're cut off from their families. So they need our support, and we believe this law is part of providing that support. It's another message to them that those parents everywhere, the rules are the same. The field is the same. The principles are the same. And that's why we think this is the right bill. It attacks the right statutes. And we'd ask for your support. We'd be glad to answer any questions. We're done. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and other members of the committee, my name is Greg Horner. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney in Clackamas County. And John asked me to come along today to briefly describe the two cases that we ended up trying. The first case involved a 17-month-old child who had what's called a cystic hygroma. It was a swelling in her neck and below her chin. It was first noticed just a few months after her birth, and over time it grew and expanded. It was sensitive to various kinds of illnesses like a cold, and she became sick about a month or so before her death with a cold that inflamed this hygroma. It was really kind of a swelling, and it ended up impeding her ability to breathe, and pneumonia was developed as a result of that. We had experts, a pediatrician from Emmanuel, who came in and testified. We had an infectious disease, a pediatric infectious disease doctor that testified. Both of them were unequivocal in their belief that this child, had she received medical treatment, even as late as the day in which she died, would have survived. The second case involved a different scenario in that the child was 16 years of age, and he had a urinary bladder obstruction, is what it was called. And we learned way more than I ever wanted to know about that urinary system, but we learned from the top doctors in the state, again from Emmanuel, about what this was and how it could have been treated. It was a disease that is basically formed in utero, and under current medical conditions, as well as 16 years ago, it could have been identified through standard prenatal care. And it would have been resolved within weeks following this child's birth through a medical procedure that would have addressed this obstruction. Won't get into all the details, but ultimately what happened over time was this obstruction ended up destroying the child's kidneys, and that's what ended up killing him. The doctors were also, including the medical examiner and the nephrologist, who is a kidney expert, pediatric kidney expert, as well as a surgeon who is involved in this kind of work, were again unequivocal in their belief that had the child received medical care, again, even as late as the day on which he died, that the child could have been saved. One of the common denominators were that as the child was expiring, in both cases, no medical test efforts were made, no efforts were made to bring medical treatment, including up to and right at the time of death. The first time that they made any efforts, the parents, for any kind of medical treatment was to call 911 to report that their child had died. The very first doctor that saw the 16-year-old, 16 years old, he had this medical condition his entire life. The first doctor to see him was the medical examiner. With that, I would close my conversation. I forgot one other thing. I do want to mention to you, in the course of these trials, prior to the actual presentation of the factual testimony, the actual trial of the case, in both cases, we went through several days of pretrial hearings that dealt with the constitutionality of the statutes that we were relying upon and the prosecution. The issues were raised in terms of the U.S. Constitution. And more specifically, and a little bit more of a challenge, was what the Oregon Constitution does for protection of religious freedoms. In both cases, the judge ruled that this balance between religious freedom and protection of children goes to the side of protecting children. Both of those convictions are on appeal, and I assume will be heard soon by the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon. Obviously, I don't know, but I'm very confident that our actions were well within the U.S. Constitution and the Oregon Constitution in terms of prosecution that were based on the protection of children. We made it very clear that our prosecution was not about prayer. We said that repeatedly. We told that to jurors in voir dire and in our closing arguments. This is not about prayer. There's nothing about prayer that is in a violation of the law. What these cases were about was the failure to provide adequate medical care. And that's what the basis of our prosecution was. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address you today.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Doug Harkleroad, and I'm the retired district attorney from Lane County. For the last 2 years, I've been representing the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I've submitted a written testimony in support of House Bill 2721. I shall not read that to you. You're all happy about that, I'm sure. I would just tell you that children are precious in our communities. We all know that. In our society, freedom to practice a religion of choice is a fundamental right, but it is not without limits. And when you have to balance those two things, which I think this bill does appropriately, you fall on the side of protecting the children. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the panel? Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Being the father of a beautiful, perfect child who enjoys the greatest, best medical care the world has to offer, I just want to breathe to my friend from Milwaukee and who's come at all those come after a collective amen. But my question is, you touched on the constitutionality. I'd imagine some person out there will test this law. Other states have, and I know every state's constitution is different, but have other states had to go through this, and have others tested it in other states as far as constitutionality, and has it went to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court? Do you have some history there?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with this extensively, and what was surprising to me, which it seemed like kind of a novel issue that was arising for the first time in 2008, it turns out the U.S. Supreme Court has been dealing with this for decades and decades. So the issue of freedom of religion versus issues relating to the care and treatment of children started clear back in the 20s and the 30s. And the U.S. Supreme Court has been absolutely unequivocal in that, in supporting the laws that protect children. The question that was less clear was the Oregon Constitution. There was a case out of, I believe it was Linn County, in which there was a conviction for somewhat similar circumstances, and the court ruled that the prosecution in that case was legal. We relied on that extensively in our argument that the Oregon Constitution is equivalent, basically, in terms of its protection of religious freedoms versus children. Now, I think these convictions will give the Oregon court another opportunity to weigh in on that, but I'm very confident that we're on the right side of this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Tobey.
It's not really a question, but I just want to commend these gentlemen for working so hard over the years on a very, very difficult situation with no assurance of the outcome. So I appreciate your effort to protect the children of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, I'll call Dr. Lace and Rita Swan, please. And thank you. You can go in any order you'd like, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Could I request that Dr. Lace goes first? I know he has another appointment.
Okay. Yes, please.
Appointment. Thank you. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Lace. I'm a pediatrician practicing here in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. My testimony will be very brief. I strongly supported the work back in 1999 on House Bill 2494, which repealed 5 of the 9 statutes that were on the book that allowed for non-treatment or non-medical treatment of children and relied solely on spiritual treatment. Since that time, we thought the statutes had been changed enough that it was going to be clear to everybody involved that we would have no further children dying because of lack of medical care. That was the case. You've already heard about the cases that were presented. The we just want to make sure that there is a very clear and consistent message to parents regarding their duty to seek out medical care when their child is sick. We don't care what their background is, what their spiritual beliefs are. Every child has the right to receive adequate medical care to allow them to achieve adulthood in a good manner. I'll relate one story. After the 1999 bill was passed, several years later, I got involved with a case that DHS was called on. It was a 15-year-old young girl whose parents had relied on faith healing. At that time, she was in severe respiratory distress. She couldn't finish a sentence without taking four or five breaths. I mean, a short little sentence. But the parents had chosen to rely solely on faith. We went out numerous times, and there was the threat that perhaps she would be removed if the parents did not go along. But we worked out a compromise with the family. I provided free care, free medication to her, and actually the intervention was very, very simple. She blossomed. She grew very well. And when she became 18, she was now legally able to go her own way and not come in any further for medical care. I have no idea what happened to her after that time. But the Marion County DA, the DHS workers here in Marion County felt that the interpretation of the law was clear enough that that was fine to go ahead. You heard about the case up in Clackamas County. There were some ambiguities, some not so clear interpretation, you know, on the parents' part. And so nothing happened to that boy. He was not as lucky, and he ended up dying. So we would like to make sure that we remove any ambiguity. We remove the last four statutes that exist on the books and make a clear and consistent message to parents as well as to anybody else that's involved with the care of children. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Lice?
Yeah.
Doctor, if you need to go, you can.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you taking your valuable time to come in. And please go ahead.
Chairman Barker and Krieger and members of House Judiciary, I am Rita Swan of Salem, Oregon. I am president of the membership organization Children's Healthcare is a Legal Duty, which works to stop child abuse and neglect related to religious or cultural beliefs. My husband and I were lifelong Christian Scientists until 1977, when we lost our only son because following the church's beliefs against medical care. We left the church right after his death and have dedicated our lives to promoting the rights of children to medical care. By this summer, I will have spent half my life on this effort. We believe laws clearly requiring all parents to provide medical care when children are at risk of serious harm are actually a relief to many conflicted, frightened parents in faith healing sects. And Mr. Foote mentioned that also. Religion-based medical neglect has cost the lives of many Oregon children. In 1998, the media reported on 78 children's graves in the Followers of Christ Cemetery near Oregon City. Representative Bruce Starr then introduced a bill to repeal 9 of Oregon's religious exemptions. And that year, the legislature repealed 5 of them. Many of us hoped that would be enough to persuade the followers to take sick children to doctors. And we did not hear of another follower's child dying of medical neglect until 2003. But since 2008, 3 more of their children have died of treatable conditions without medical care, and 1 has a permanent disability from medical neglect. House Bill 2721 has therefore been introduced to repeal the remaining 4 religious exemptions pertaining to medical care of sick children so that the code will have a clear, consistent message on a parent's duty. And I could describe these exemptions that... No?
You don't need to.
Okay. What I would, just one point I would make on page 2 of my testimony. Oregon has a religious defense to homicide by abuse or neglect and to manslaughter. And these are extremely unusual. Oregon is one of only 3 states in the nation with a religious defense to homicide. Oregon is one of only 3 states in the nation with a religious defense to manslaughter. Oregon is the only state in the nation with a religious defense to both crimes. Repealing these religious exemptions gives Oregon children equal protection by giving all parents the same duty to provide medical care at the same threshold of seriousness in a child's injury or illness. It will show that our society places a high value on the life of every child, and that parents must do everything in their power to provide a child with necessities of life. Oregon's current laws reward absolutism and fanaticism. Parents may commit homicide by neglect or manslaughter with impunity in the current laws if they give care or treatment solely by spiritual means. That's a quote from the statute. But not if they use any material means along with their spirituality, as most people would do. And also, Oregon's religious exemption from criminal mistreatment is given only to parents who hire, quote, an accredited practitioner of spiritual treatment from a, quote, recognized church to pray for the child. Surely this law is a violation of the Establishment Clause, which prohibits the state from favoring one religion over another. It is simply wrong for Oregon to have a law allowing any parents to, quote, recklessly cause a child's death with extreme indifference to human life. Now, that's the homicide by abuse or neglect statute. And we are not claiming that any parents in this group in Oregon City are necessarily recklessly causing a child's death with extreme indifference to human life. But it's just not right to have a law that says anybody can do that. And, you know, you all know from watching the television that there are many people out there in the world who do commit terrible crimes in the name of religion with extreme indifference to human life. This is a very unusual law. As I say, only three states in the nation have a religious defense to homicide or manslaughter. It's unwise. It sends a bad message about Oregon's values. Representative Nolan told us that some legislators want data, so I would like to discuss that topic very briefly. On page 3, first, it is impossible to know how many children do die in the United States because of religion-based medical neglect. A pediatrician and I did the largest study of child mortality in faith-healing sects, which is in your packets. Of 172 deaths between 1975 and 1995, we found that 140 would have had at least a 90% likelihood of survival with timely medical care. The 172 were just the cases that came to our attention and that we could gather enough information on to include in a study published by a prominent medical journal. Shortly after this study appeared, the Oregon Press went to the Followers of Christ Cemetery and found 78 children buried there, plus 12 child deaths in a satellite congregation in Idaho. That was 90 deaths and a faith-healing sect that the doctor and I had never heard about when we were doing our research. It strongly suggests that there are a lot that we don't know about. Now, since Oregon instituted the medical examiner system, good records have been kept on the deaths of the Followers of Christ children in Oregon City. It is still not possible to produce exact data on the increased risk of death to these children because we do not know how many children are in the congregation. In 1999, the state medical examiner testified to the legislature that an estimate that their deaths were like 20 times above the statewide average. And the medical examiner's office also produced the data that I show at the bottom of page 3. It's for a six-year period, 1993 to 1998. In the fourth column, the percent of total deaths in Clackamas County for those years that were to children under 15 years old, only 1.6% of the deaths in Clackamas County during those years were among children under 15 years old. But in the Followers of Christ, see the last column, there were an average of 18.59% of their deaths were to children under 15 years old. unless this congregation is a much younger cohort than the population of Clackamas County as a whole, their children are at much greater risk of death than children in the general population. The medical examiner's office also has data showing that deaths among followers of Christ children declined by 38.9% between 2000 and 2008. We believe that is due to the improvement in Oregon laws enacted in 1999. And we believe deaths will decline again with the passage of House Bill 2721. Although the Clackamas County deaths have been the catalyst for this bill, we do not consider that this bill targets a particular church. Instead, what it does is closes the loopholes in the child protection laws so that they extend to everyone equally. The ultimate purpose of the criminal code is deterrence. Laws gain their deterrent value and society's respect when they are fair and clear. HB 2721 is needed to achieve these qualities. Our hope, our strong hope, is that this bill will change behavior and no more children will be harmed. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Ms. Swan? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate the emotional issue, strength to come up and testify today, and we really do appreciate you doing that. Thank you. No further. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2721. The next item on the agenda is a public hearing on House Bill 2698. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm a little bit nervous before you today, not because this is the August Judiciary Committee, but because your new committee counsel, Aaron Knott, may remember me from his classes in high school and probably has a lot of stories that he could tell the committee. So we'll hope not to anger him and keep him from telling those stories. This bill, House Bill 2698, that's before you today, is really about a simple principle. And that principle is innocent until proven guilty. The idea for the bill came to me from a constituent who responded that she had run into difficulty and had known people who had difficulty finding work because of arrests that had been on their record that did not lead to conviction. I then asked another constituent, my good friend Eric Blumenthal, who you'll hear from shortly, about this as my a friend and an attorney to look into the matter. And after some investigation, came to realize that there were a number of issues within state law around expungement of arrests that looked like they would be in need of change. And that's what House Bill 2698 does. Essentially, House Bill 2698 does two major things. It shortens the time period for a person who is arrested but not subsequently convicted to be eligible to apply to have that arrest expunged if there is a previous arrest on the record. Under current law, there is a waiting period. If you are arrested and you are not convicted, there is a waiting period if you are then subsequently arrested years later and again found not guilty before you can apply to have that arrest removed from your record. This would shorten that time period. It also shortens the time period if you are arrested and convicted of a crime. There is a much longer waiting period before if you can apply to have a subsequent arrest that does not result in a conviction removed from your record. Now, I want to clarify a couple of things. First, this doesn't apply to traffic violations like driving under the influence. Second, this does not circumvent victims' rights. Victims still have the ability to participate in that process for the expungement. And third, it does not hide the arrest from the court or from law enforcement officers that might seek to know about your background. What this bill does is, in the process of looking for employment, if you had this arrest sealed from an employer, you could legally answer no on a question on a form that asks if you had been arrested for the purposes of employment. Now, all of you know that we are in a tough economic time, and there are a lot of unemployed people who are looking for work. The issue here is that there is a lot of competition in folks looking for work, and if you are a qualified applicant applying for a job, it can be a black mark on your record to have to answer that you have been arrested before, even if you were completely innocent of the crime and were not convicted. And in my mind, we ought to make it easier for people who are innocent and who are innocent until proven guilty to be able to apply for a job and compete on an equal footing with other job applicants. And that is really the purpose of this bill. You may hear from others that there is the larger issue of expungement that needs work, that there is a proposed work group process to deal with that. I would submit that this particular bill, because it deals primarily with arrests and that do not result in conviction, is a separate issue and one that cannot wait for unemployed Oregonians who are out there looking for work. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
I do have one. Co-chairs, members of the committee, and of course, hey, Jules, you know I couldn't resist the opportunity to put you on the spot a little. But more seriously, a question I had when I was looking over this bill, and I'm going to refer to Section 6B, which is located right at the top of page 3. I'm looking at lines 7, 8, and 9. Small change. It says a conviction that has been set aside under this section may not be considered for the purpose of determining whether this paragraph is applicable. Now, how I read that is in existing, so you're convicted of something, we'll say theft, and you complete your probation, you do everything you're supposed to do, and then according to the beginning of you have 3 years after that time you can make a motion to set aside. So you make the motion to set aside. You then pick up another theft and you're convicted again. 3 years later you set aside the motion and or you make a motion to set aside and it's again set aside. And in the previous law you couldn't do that. Because the old conviction that you set aside would sort of keep the clock running on the new one, so you'd have to go all the way out to 10 years to make another motion to set aside, as I understand it. With this one, can you just continue making motions to set aside every 3 years?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Mr. Knott, I would refer you to, and perhaps I should punt briefly on the question and let Mr. Blumenthal give his testimony. He's the attorney and I am not, but my understanding would be that I believe this is covered to some degree in the frequently asked questions that went out to the committee under the heading, can someone repeatedly use the expungement process to hide an extensive criminal record? And the first line says, not realistically. And I think because theoretically that may be possible, but because that the court and the decision-making process would have access to see that prior history and victims would have an ability to see that it may not be realistic that such a process would occur. But again, I'm not an attorney.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, my name is Eric Blumenthal. I'm a constituent and attorney. I also support this bill. I just wanted to follow up on committee counsel's Knox question. It is possible, but one thing to remember is that a person can't apply for an expungement until 3 years after they complete their sentence for whatever they've been charged with. So, you know, that expands the time even more. So, for example, if the person's put on 3 years probation, that clock wouldn't even begin until the completion of their probation. Moreover, typically the kinds of people who are racking up convictions aren't the type of people who are immediately walking into the office and obtaining expungement. So it's a very narrow window. Plus, there's other time periods. If you have a pending charge, you're not allowed to apply for an expungement. Any time that, you know, when you're talking about arrests, if you're evading process, that also tolls the clock. So there's a lot of tolling periods in this statute that would make it difficult for someone to do that, although not impossible. Just thought maybe I should add then, just to echo what he says, that House Bill 2698 does relax eligibility requirements to expunge arrests and convictions. The biggest thing that this statute does is it lowers the time period so that you can just become eligible to apply. And that's an important distinction to make because it's not, these things don't automatically go away. And in fact, they never truly go away. They're still accessible to district attorneys. They're still accessible to defense attorneys. They're still accessible if they're the subject of civil litigation. What it is it just enables a person to submit typically a job application and be free from an unconvicted arrest or an arrest where charges were never even filed. And foreseeably, if you have that type of situation where you're arrested and there's no charges twice in a 3-year span, you won't be able to get that arrest expunged. And so this law just opens up that eligibility.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about prayer in the last bill and talk about your high school pals. My prayers have been answered. My high school pals have never showed up to testify in this building.
Hey, thank you, pal.
That's true.
No, I'm sorry. But Representative Olson.
Eric, I'm trying to, okay, just really one quick question. The 3-year window period begins immediately after post-prison supervision is completed? Probation side of it? That's the way I get it.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Olson. What it states is that any time after the lapse of, and this is the way the law is now, and this bill does not change this at all, at any time after the lapse of 3 years from the date of pronouncement of the judgment, any defendant who has fully complied and performed the sentence of the court. And so it would have to be, and certainly I would imagine a post-prison supervision would be part of the sentence of the court, and therefore you wouldn't be eligible for it until after. But I would have to check for post-prison supervision. I'm not entirely sure, but I believe that post-prison supervision, because it's part of the sentence, would also. And also, yeah. So.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair,
yes.
May I also respond?
Please.
The length of time that this bill changes the waiting period to is to some degree arbitrary. We wanted to make it shorter. I would be happy to work on this bill if there's interest in doing it on making sure that that time period meets with the committee's approval. I would refer you back to the principle in the bill, which I do think is sound, of that trying to make sure that somebody who may not have ever been involved with a crime or who is wrongly arrested doesn't have to live with that black mark when applying for a job. And I would imagine a situation where I commit a crime and somebody arrests Representative Hicks because people can't tell us apart. And I would imagine that Representative Hicks might want to have some relief from that arrest before he applies for a job. So
I'd redirect them to Representative Lindsay. We'd both get off the hook.
Good call. Doppelganger caucus.
Okay, thank you. Doug Harkleroad and Ann Pratt.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Doug Harkleroad. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. As written, the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance is opposed to House Bill 2698. We read it significantly different than the representative who dispresented it to you. We don't have an objection to the arrest portion and the expungement of arrest, but this bill on page 3 on line 4 says a person convicted within the, and then it goes from 10 years to 5 years. This bill shortens the period on convictions, not just arrests, and that's our problem with this bill. What I also think is, any of you who had a chance to actually work your way through this bill, this thing has been just a nightmare for lawyers to read for many, many years. We had a flowchart in the Lane County District Attorney's Office to try to figure out if somebody was eligible or not, and we'd run it through that. What I'd suggest here is that this just needs to go to an interim work group, and this whole thing needs to be reworked. But if you don't do that, then I would suggest we need an amendment that deals only with arrests and not convictions, because this shortens the time period on convictions as well as arrests. That's all I have. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Krieger. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I also interpreted the bill in the same way, that it shortens the time period for seeking to have 10 years to 5 years. These are all very serious crimes, and I think it's outrageous to expunge these crimes even in 10 years. And victims don't get a chance to expunge the memories or the effect that the crimes have had on them. They get no break in what's happened to them. In 2005, we requested a bill that changed assaults 3 to a B felony, and also raise the crime seriousness. I can't speak for all the victims in all these crimes, but as a MAD advocate, I certainly can tell you I've seen the results of the DUI assaults, the assault threes. Many of them, of the assault threes, fall into assaults. DUI assaults fall into assault threes. I know several of you here remember when we came in 2005 and Sarah Edwards came to testify. She was a victim of a horrible accident, horrible crash, and she was 19 at the time, and she went from being a 19-year-old college student who aspired to be a veterinarian in a split second to a woman with devastatingly catastrophic injuries and the mental capacity of a 12-year-old. I went to Sarah's birthday party a few years ago, her 30th birthday party, and it was like no other. Sarah will never get better, will never continue to stop, will continue to endure surgeries, physical therapy, speech therapy, and is a permanent heartache for her parents and herself. And Sarah also lives on state assistance. While the man who maimed her, took away her life, and killed her boyfriend was eligible years ago to have his conviction set aside, there are still many other victims out here who will be affected by this outrageous proposal that calls for setting aside of these felony crimes in just 5 years. If you do the crime, you take responsibility for it and you own it permanently. Criminal proceedings are all about finding the truth, and expunging or setting aside is about hiding the truth. Passing this bill allows that to happen just that much sooner for these crimes. I urge you to table this bill. I do agree that arrests are a different story. Arrests that don't develop into convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Garrett.
Just very briefly, I just wanted to clarify, and Doug, I think I would support having an interim group study the statute, but if we can do something this session, I'd like to. I think I heard you both say if we amend this to deal just with arrests, then neither of you has a problem with it. Is that right?
Doug Harkrode here, speaking for the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. Yes, we could help draft some language to that effect, if that was the question. My apologies for not saying the proper introduction there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative, come on.
Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Krieger, I apologize for coming up again. I just wanted to make one quick point for the committee, just to say that I agree for cases like Sarah's, that is heartfelt testimony, and that is why this bill does not apply to DUIs or and would only apply to Class C felonies, so those crimes would not be eligible under this bill. So, thank you.
close the public hearing on House Bill 2698. Further business to come before the committee? Committee adjourned.